I'd like to thank the Sinaites for what they are teaching me about this land that they have called home for thousands of years. I have been here only for 4 years, and I've learned a great deal from my contact with the Sinaites personally and from my contact with their history as we have written it. There is some good history out there for us to be acquainted with, and I encourage all of you to seek that out. We will not arrive as members of a post-contact settler culture until we have learned a way in which to honor the past.
Many of us in the Columbia Basin were born somewhere else. Most families can only trace their ties to this land back two or three generations. There have long been voices here, however. The first non-native explorer to penetrate these mountains was David Thompson in 1811. He found a rich indigenous culture in these valleys. Carbon-dated remains reveal that that culture is at least 10,000 years old. To put that in context, we can say that the Sinaites have been in this region for at least 50 times as long as we have. Sometimes called the Arrow Lakes people, the Sinaites nation flourished by respecting every facet in the web of life. For the next hour, you will be hearing segments from our conversations with Marilyn James, spokesperson for the Sinaites, and Robert Watt, who is the appointed caretaker of the Sinaites' ancient winter village and burial grounds in Vallakin, B.C. Robert and Marilyn will comment about their experiences as Sinaites' descendants. Little is known locally about those who came before us, and although many myths and misconceptions about the Sinaites abound, their culture is still alive, still connected with this land, and still determined to leave a legacy to the next generation.
It's easy for people to say, oh, the Sinaites, there was never any Indian people who stayed in Nelson. Nelson was just such a spiritual, special place. No one ever lived there. Well, there's a reason why Native people haven't been in Nelson for a long time, because they were targets. We were used for target practice by miners. I mean, there's such a evil story of the first non-native people who started coming into this territory, who were looking for gold and also for lead, and they would show what they wanted to the native people, and the native people would go, oh, yeah, I can show you where that's at. And then they would show them where gold or where lead was, and then the white people would go there and find it, and they'd kill the Indian so the Indian couldn't tell anybody else. And so it was just sort of their insurance policy of how that all happened. And when where settlements are today, that's where Native people had settled before, because those were the best places to settle. It made sense. And as you can see on Arrow Lakes, any place you could have touched down anyway along that lake, there was something there. And so a lot of places, just like Castle Gar and Brilliant, where the Dukhobor settlement is now, was a huge settlement for the Sinaics people. And as you all live and are part of the Columbia Basin, we were the first peoples here. And it's important for you to understand that so that now you can begin to understand the contemporary issues and the contemporary ideas about what's going on, so you can begin having some critical thinking processes about what actually happened and actually being supportive in a way that isn't oppressive.
And I'd grown up not very far away from here, maybe about 70 miles south of here. But I remember hiking all over and traveling all over. And then it was a thing, like when we were young, we'd come up to a little creek or something, be walk along the road or anywhere, you'd stop and get a drink, and you wouldn't even think, should I boil this water? Is this going to be safe? Am I going to get giardia? And same with swimming. We'd swim all over the place, all kind of places. Wherever we'd catch fish, we'd eat them and stuff. Now it's so different, because now there's these young people around, and we got to kind of tell them, hey, don't be drinking the water out there. It might not be safe. Just saying that that's how much things changed, and I'm not even that old. Even you guys, even you probably noticed a lot of that. Just like there used to be more old growth here and there, less populated areas, more little wilderness. I know for sure you noticed the deer population go down. Remember those big herds that used to be here? Like there used to be like 30 to 50 in a herd roaming around. In the winter, they'd come down, they'd roam through this whole valley, and it. And now, you just see little families. And all of us are going to have to try to do something to make it better for the future, and especially for the children. Hopefully, there'll be some of that stuff still around for the future generations.
The Sinex people lived in harmony with this land. They had extensive trade routes known as grease trails, traveled by foot and with sturgeon-nosed canoes, lived in pit houses, hunted caribou, fished and gathered wild plants and medicines. They led semi-nomadic lives in the summer months, but would return to permanent villages in the winter. The Sinex speak an interior Salish language. They speak many words common to the Okanagan, the Shuswap, and the Spokane peoples. Although they sometimes had battle with the Kootenai Indians to the east and other tribes, the Sinex are not a warrior people. They were considered the mother tribe of this region, and acted as a kind of court that was called upon to settle disputes between tribes. Today we can enjoy this beautiful region in spite of our highways, dumps, clear cuts, and dams that clutter the landscape. The Sinex left little evidence of their passing.
Where we're still really finding a lot of resistance is the government doesn't recognize us, and they've entered into a treaty process in British Columbia. But the BC treaty process, the government wants settled. They want it settled with the Indians, and they want it settled now. And we're saying, no, this is our territory, and we're not interested in the treaty process. But one of the things that we are interested in, because above everything else, before Indian people have rights, they have responsibilities. They have responsibilities to their land. They have responsibilities to their resources. Right now, our land base is really taxed. The resources are being harvested in a way that is just, it's too much. We don't have accountability in what resources are there. We don't have inventories. If we don't have inventories, how do we know what we're doing on our land is being impacted? If something goes missing, then how do we even know it's gone if we don't have inventories until it's totally gone? We don't know how big those impacts are. And even the word Sinaixt, what we call ourselves, Aixt is a fish. It's a bull trout. Sin is the place of that fish. Sinaixt is what we call ourselves because we're people and that fish is very special to us. And bull trout is an extremely important species because bull trout requires an extremely cold climate to survive. If you alter the temperature of their habitat just a fraction, they'll die. They can't survive. And now it's really important to us because when they put in Grand Coulee Dam, the androgynous salmon don't come up the Columbia River anymore. We don't have access to salmon. Well, Sinaix, that Aix fish, is a salmonid. And it's important. It's a landlocked salmon. It's a resident fish. And so it's very important to us as the namesake of that fish we really need to know, and we really need to make sure that those fish are taken care of, and they're here, and they're here not just for us to have right now. In fact, we don't even feel good about going out and fishing for them or taking them because we don't have proper inventories.
Some Sinex people believe that their ancestors were victim to deliberate smallpox infestations. Such epidemics were common throughout the Americas in the first few centuries of European migration, a time described by some as the Great Dying. As they were the mother tribe, it is speculated that the government and economic powers of the time targeted the Sinex in order to diminish resistance from other tribal groups. Whatever the reason, the Sinex found themselves dying in great numbers, scared and exhausted. Many of the survivors fled to the southern portion of their territory. They sought the solace of the Colville Indian Reservation in Washington State, where they didn't have to worry about bullets and miners. These people were unwillingly assimilated by the U.S. government into the Colville Confederated Tribe. Although even government records reveal that 80% of traditional Sinex territory is above the border, the Sinex have no native rights here in Canada. Other survivors were absorbed into neighboring tribes of this region and are no longer recognized by the government as Sinex.
This is the land survival story of the Sinex peoples. This story was told to me by Elder Eva Orr. The Legend of Frog Mountain. Many generations ago, a drought covered the land and lasted for many years. The people of the land suffered greatly, as the land could not provide for them. The plant people disappeared, and with this disappearance, other life forms could not sustain themselves and also began to disappear. The pressure of survival within the heartland of Sinai territory surrounded all of those who were left alive. Many chose to move away from their homes and to the parameters of their lands where survival seemed more likely. Many left their territory altogether to seek survival in strange lands. The loss of human life and suffering too great to bear in the land that had for so long been their salvation. In the heartland of the Sinaiks was a village which was led by an elder whose people had suffered and lost many lives. The elder encouraged these people to go while they still might have the strength for the journey to find survival. The elder assisted the villagers with their preparations, seeing that all belongings of any value were packed for the journey. He, however, was gathering his strength to watch his people leave. He had decided to stay. Each of the villagers had, in their own way, bid farewell to their ancestors and to the place of their hearts and memories. When all the packing was complete, this story gets me because this woman right here, her name is Haha Aiken Eva Orr. She is the elder for all of us. She brought us here. She made us come here. She's been our strength and our inspiration, and she's 90 years old now. And whenever I read this story, I think about her going on and what that's going to mean to our people. And so when I read this story, because she gave me this story, that's what I think about. And it always gets me really riled up. But they're good tears. He had decided to stay. Each of the villagers had, in their own way, bid farewell to their ancestors and to the place of their hearts and memories. When all the packing was complete, and the villagers were prepared to leave, their leader bid them farewell. The people of the village pleaded with the old man to come with them. He refused, stating that he was too old, probably wouldn't survive the journey, and he could not leave the place of his ancestors where his heart and memories were still alive. He wanted only to be alive at this place. If he could not be there, then he did not want to be. The villagers cried for the elder to journey with them. And though he was greatly moved by these pleas and their tears, he would not leave with them. It was decided by all of the villagers that even though they all wished to stay with their elder in the place of their hearts and memories, some would have to take the journey. The village decision about who would make the journey for survival was based on the strength of the individual and certain gifts they possessed in terms of knowledge and skill. All valuables were sent with those on the journey to allow them to be able to have trade goods of value and to increase their ability to survive and make a way for themselves in a new place. All the other villagers refused to leave their elder and bid their fellow villagers farewell. The elder knew that survival would be harder now that all the village's valuables had been sent away with the people's, and the people's hearts were heavy with the burden of death. The people would begin to question their own decisions about staying in the place that held only death, and this would further burden the land that already suffered. The elder prepared himself for fasting and prayer. The elder told his people that he would go to fast and pray and ask the Creator for help, and that he would return in a few days, and so he left. The elder received a visitor in the form of a frog as he was fasting and praying for the land and the people. The frog came to the elder and spoke to him in the tongue of the people. The frog said, "You people must go to the banks of the river and dig caves back into the banks along the riverbed. You must spend the winter in these caves, and we will come and help you. If you do this, everything will be okay for you and your people, and you will survive." After giving his message, the frog left, and the elder wondered if he had actually had a visit or if it was just his imagination. The elder decided that he would dig the caves, thinking that even if it was just his imagination, the caves at least would be proper graves for the people who surely would not survive the winter. The elder returned to the people and told them about the visit from the frog. No one questioned the elder, the visit from the frog, or the necessity to dig the caves. Even though they were weak and it took them many days to complete, the villagers dug the caves in the riverbanks. Everyone helped while others tried to scrape an existence from the land and prepare for the winter to come. They knew that the supplies they were able to gather would not see them through the season of cold. Even with all the people trying to gather supplies for the winter, they could not have gathered enough to survive, as there just wasn't enough to gather. So the people quietly and diligently did as the elder asked until the caves were complete. As the season of cold laid its blanket upon the earth, all of the villagers moved into the caves in the riverbanks. They survived on their meager supplies, only eating enough to stay alive, no more. The children cried with hunger, and the others suffered to know that they could do nothing. To pass the time, they would tell stories about the creation to both entertain the children and to light the path of the ancestors that they thought they would soon walk. When the supplies ran out altogether, the people began to prepare for death. Instead of death, the frogs came into the caves and offered themselves to the people who ate them to stay alive. The frogs continued to come and offer themselves to the people for the rest of the winter until one day a frog came into the cave and spoke, "Do not eat me. You may all leave these caves now and go on to the land where you will find enough to live. Your suffering is now over. The land will change and will be able to again give to you for your survival. I will from this day forward be a symbol to you. When you look at me, you see a creature who is insignificant, a creature who seems not to impact life, threaten life, or sustain life in any way. We have shown you through our love and offering that even something believed to be insignificant can change the course of events and become a powerful being in deed and symbol. I will show you how powerful we are, and we will give you a symbol that the Sinaic should always remember." With those final words, the frog hopped and grew, his face rose to the sky as he grew and became the mountain, Frog Mountain. I have told this story in my own words, which in my opinion will never do justice to the way in which it was told to me. I tell you now in a non-traditional way to light the path for your education about the Sinaiks. And that's Frog Mountain. Asked by Eva, like Eva called me in and said, "You're from these people, you know. I want you to help and go see what you can do." And it was from that point that I really began to understand my Sinaiks roots.
It was Eva's push. It was Eva's desire. It was Eva's strength. It was Eva's spirituality that sort of gathered us and called us back. And so she's been the one that has been the root. She's 90 years old and she says, "Oh gee whiz, those people, my elders just used to make me sit and listen to them for hours and hours and hours, and I wanted to go play. And I wanted to go off. I had other things I wanted to do." But she was made to sit and listen. And all the stories that she passes on now, and all those bits of history, were all the things that she had to hear. And she said, "Gee whiz, not just once. I had to hear them over and over and over and over again." And that's because she had to be able to repeat them word for word in exactly the way that they were told to her. They were smart in how they used their art. They told the story to inspire people, and they might change it just a little bit. Even today, when you read a storybook to a child, if you insert that child's name in there and they become a character, or you read them a story about something they're experiencing, that child can relate in a way that they couldn't if it was a story about Dick and Jane or whoever. And so they use those stories to inspire people through some real hardships. And they might change the story to depict the actual hardship that they were going through. The other thing that they would do is they would use stories to show people, like this story, that something insignificant is really powerful and can share love and can be a symbol and can be of such a greatness that you can't just cast it aside. Every little thing in the world has an incredible value. They also use stories as tools to teach morality. And you can take a group of people, and somebody might be doing something wrong, right? And they're doing something that everybody knows about. But they won't say, "Well, you did that." They'll sit down and they'll tell this macabre story. And they'll interject humor. And it'll be exactly what that person's doing. And their face will probably turn beet red and they'll probably stomp out. But everybody will get it, including that person. And it was just a gentle way of telling them that they're doing something wrong. And not to chastise that person openly in a gathering, but to use those incidents and how people are, even in everyday lives, to really know and understand right from wrong, correct way of being, that you don't have to punish somebody in a harsh way for them to get a lesson. And stories also served another purpose. when we want to learn history now, we open a book. Well, it's not history. It's someone's version of what happened. But these stories are part of oral traditions, especially historical stories, are stories that depicted pieces of history were passed on and passed on and passed on verbatim. And so those stories never altered.
British Columbia entered the Confederation of Canada in 1871, but was the only province that was ever allowed to do so without any formal treaties. The Indian Act was established at this time, and it forced many undesirable laws and conditions upon Native groups across Canada. By the 1950s, there was only one person who was legally recognized as Senaixt in Canada. She died in 1953, and so by 1956, the government declared the Senaixt extinct and closed the book on a nation that had existed for many thousands of years.
They used to go out behind this trailer next to the chicken coop and tan hides. And it stinks. Oh, you wouldn't believe it stinks. But they would go out there and they would talk the language, and we were never allowed to be around them when they spoke the language because my mother had been taken away to residential school and was really treated awful, like awful for speaking the language. And so even though my mother's a fluent speaker, she never wanted us children to have to suffer, so she never gave us the language. So whenever they'd go out there, of course, you never understand a word they're saying, but I think it was just that sort of, because it was kind of taboo too. I used to go out and elbow around the trailer, you know, and sneak, and they'd be out there talking in the Indian language and laughing and carrying on and having a good time and telling stories, but in the language. And so I used to lay on the ground in the wheat patch and listen to them out there tanning hides, and like that's one of my fondest memories, my very fondest. The things that are special to me all represent things that my people did. And everything they did it with such joy. Like, I went out there and scraped those bloody hides for 3 friggin' years, and all I could think about was, Jesus, this stinks. Oh, God, the flies! You know, and I would just carry on, and it wasn't like them. They were out there, it still stunk, but they were out there, and it was a family thing, and they did something, and at the end of it, they had these beautiful hides. I mean, they're just incredible. And the way that they did it, like, that's also an art that they passed on to their children, their way, their culture. It was all tied together. And that was the gift, right? That was broken. And I got to see it as a child. But I got to see it. I got to experience it. And someday, when I get old, I probably still won't be able to speak the language, but when I get old, that's one of the things that I would like to pass on, because I know that my kids would come out there when I was tanning the hides, or scraping the hides, and they'd stand way back. Oh, God, Mom, that stinks. Are you going to be done soon? They'd stand way off. Are you going to be done soon? And that, even though it was like that, it still was a way that they could relate to me and actually see me out there trying and struggling to bring along something that is really turning into sort of a dying art. People just don't do this anymore. They don't like to be out there, flies buzzing them and stink coming off of them. But that was really something like, and I think when my children look at me, they'll probably say, or when they remember back, they'll go, "Oh yeah, and Mom, she was such a crank when she was doing all that stuff. Remember?"
In 1980, the Ministry of Highways began planning the construction of a new road and bridge through Balakan in the Slocan Valley. Construction was halted when many artifacts, skeletal remains, and pit house depressions were discovered. Archaeologists studied the ancient winter village and burial grounds, but no Sinaik's descendants were contacted, as they have no legal native status in Canada. In 1988, the ministry recommenced construction of the road. The government proposed establishing an information and picnic area at the site. When Elder Eva Orr learned of these events, she sent some of her people to investigate and to help recover the ancestral remains that had been taken to museums.
The winter dance, it is a way right from here for our people. The Sinaik's people. It is one of our ways. And it died down. Now it's just now starting to come back. But I feel so good that we're involved in it. And we got a part of that. As Sinaik's people, we don't have to travel out to anybody else's area to try to pick up an Indian way or another way to work for us. Our way is here, and it feels so good to us. It feels so comfortable, and it feels so right, and it's natural for us. Our way, our winter dance, fits us just like a real old glove or an old shoe, just so comfortable.
Our prayers, our foods, our sweat lodge ceremonies, our singing, our giveaway, everything is there. And it's the one part of the year where it all sort of comes together. And in other parts of the year, other things happen, but not all together like that. Pieces of them might happen. You might take a sweat. You might go out and dig roots and have a little root feast over that, or go pick berries and have a little gathering around that. But nothing is there just for the appreciation of the entire aspect.
And for a long time, it was really hard for our people to even carry on ceremonies. Like a lot of our ways, they were really prosecuted when people would try to do them. If it wouldn't be by the law and by the police, it'd be by the religious organizations. They'd make it really hard for our people to practice those things. So it kind of died down, and it got really low to where there wasn't a whole lot of people doing it. But in the last years, they've actually been growing. There's old people there that have been doing that all of their life, and they experienced that even when they were kids. And there's a whole bunch of other older people, and it was still really strong and really good. We know, like, if anything happens to us, as long as our children know something about that, it'll take care of them.
Again, it was Eva. She says to me, "Could you cook for me at my winter dance ceremony?" And I went, and the first part of it, I just knew it was right, it was real, it was powerful, and it just called me. And I just went and told my family, just said, "Oh man, it's so great." You know, now my mom got involved, my sister, my children all go and attend, and all those, like, just the calling back of that ceremony. And that was one way that it sort of brought me back.
In those dances, too, there's so much involved there. It helps us keep our life straightened. We look back on our past year. Just for our own selves, and we know for our own selves what caused us troubles. We can get physical help. There's healings that go on there. We get spiritual help. We get advice from, like, people and from elders, but we also get advice from somewhere else. And that advice that we get from that way always seems to be right. There's a whole spiritual part that's going on there too. I don't feel too comfortable talking too much about that because I'm not an elder and I don't know all that stuff really all that good. I'm just a regular person in there. When we have our ceremonies, a lot of the foods we eat will be traditional foods. But to make that happen through the year, we will have to like start in the springtime, going out, gathering the roots. Then we'll be gathering the berries, and all at the same time, there'll be guys out, and they'll be getting like the fish, and then the deer, elk, and every other kind of meats we'll be using. And through that, it keeps us in touch with our foods and our medicines and our plants and our animals, because we got to gather that for the ceremony. But also part of the ceremony is giving thanks for all the foods and all the medicines and plants and things that we've gotten from the year before.
When you have a traditional ceremony like that, all your traditional foods have to be represented on your table. So it's a way for us to be thankful for what we've gathered, praying about each of those. And it's not only that, but it's also the way the foods are served. The way that you take them, even on your plate, is the way that they've come out of the earth. So you take the first root is camas, the second is bitterroot, the third is carrots, then onions, potatoes. It's sort of a select order of how they come out of the ground. And that's the way that you consume them, because you appreciate what's first. And then after that, after the roots, you have the berries. And it's the way that the certain berries that we consume, like I think you call them Saskatoons, our Sarvis berries, our choke cherries, huckleberries, you know, and those all come out in an order as well. And then after that, your first meat is fish. And your second meat is a red blood meat, whether it's deer or elk or moose or whatever. But generally, we were really a caribou people. There were huge herds of caribou in this area. And then that's the way it is. That's just how you serve up your foods. And then after that, you know, you get your breads and desserts and salads or whatever else is there to serve up. But there's a traditional way that it comes out.
Part of the ceremony, too, will be like also praying that things will be good, like we'll get enough rain, we'll get enough snow for the plants, for the medicines, and for the animals. Oh, I guess that's what I really enjoy about our dances, because there's so much more than actually can meet the eye. Thing to our people is the way they approach foods or medicines. Before they gather it, they talk to that plant or that medicine, and they tell it what they're going to be doing with it and how they're going to be using it. And they might even ask it for its help, and you give thanks for it when you gather it. The fruits, all the traditional foods, are very important to our people. I know, like, they'll start in like early in the spring gathering the roots and stuff, like bitterroots and camas, then wild carrots, and wild onions, wild potatoes. That'll be some of the first stuff. And then after that, I'll start in on the berries, like the Sarvis berries, sopalelli, then the huckleberries. When you do gather them, they'll be for all different uses. But like if somebody was sick and that plant could help them, you would talk to that plant and tell it why you're gathering it. And you'd only gather what you needed for that purpose. It's not like you'd gather more than you'd need. And you'd be recognizing, too, that you'd be taking a piece of that plant, or you'd be taking the whole plant. And by recognizing it as another being, it keeps you from over-harvesting or abusing that at all. the big thing, instead of any kind of monetary or value like that, the big thing to, in the Indian way of thinking, would be you'd see that person get well, and that would be the main thing. And that would make it so it would always be there for everybody else to always use too. By putting a monetary value on it, then they overgather stuff and try to sell it like they gather more than they need, because you got to do that to be able to sell it. Then that's where things get all out of whack and out of balance. I guess that's why some Indians are so protective of talking about some of those plants and medicines, because they can be over-harvested and abused. I don't know if it's a pharmaceutical company or an herbal company, but then they find out about the bitter roots and how actually really good they are for you. Like, they're a food, but they're also like a medicine. And they went out and they gathered them like you do, like a potato field. They just took them all, you know. Through that, I know that area that happened in, because once in a while we dropped by there digging that area. And they dug it so thoroughly that they actually didn't come back there. And even areas around here, it's like that. It's not because of over-harvesting. It must be because of pollution or disturbance. That's just like that whole area down by Castlegar to Trail. The name for Castlegar in our language is like Capitals, but that stems out of Spetlum, and that's our name for bitterroot. But I went down there and looked before, and I couldn't find no bitterroots there at all. But knowing that at one time there must have been bitterroots and other foods. And so much of those foods that were actually here, I think people would have learned it the proper way of respecting them, even like talking to those foods as another being. A lot of those things would have still been here if people would have understood it that way, and not on how important food really is. For this whole area, the main food sources were like salmon and caribou. Now the salmon are gone and the caribou were gone.
Many residents of this area first learned of the presence of Sennek's descendants in 1989, when a blockade was established to halt further development of the road in Balakan. Despite a series of setbacks, the Sennek's have managed to repatriate and rebury 55 complete and fractured skeletal remains of their ancestors at the Balakan site.
What we believe is within our traditional territory. Everything has a life. Everything has a spirit. And we're not the only species on this planet that has a spirit. And every spirit of every living thing is worthy of respect and needs to be valued. And many of those things that give us life, help us along, like whether it's medicine or nutrition or aesthetics, it's very important. They're just now discovering how even having something beautiful around you, like cut flowers, can assist in producing an enzyme in the brain that helps uplift you, make you happy. So everything has a value, even if it's just for aesthetics. And if it can help you, it's worthy of respect, it's worthy of being recognized. So that's sort of all part of that, respecting every little thing. Whether it's the little fish that you don't eat that feed the fish that you do. It's kind of like the bugs that feed the birds or pollinate the plants. And all of those things benefit us in some way, directly or indirectly. And so that's all part of bringing it into the ceremony, being thankful even for the things that we don't necessarily appreciate, like mosquitoes.
Robert also talked a little bit about the idea of saying a prayer before cutting a plant or before taking something.
Or giving up not only a prayer but an offering, like offering tobacco or cloth, that plant's giving its life for you, or that deer or that rabbit or that grouse or wild turkey or whatever it is, it's actually giving its life for you. And I think lots of times we don't even connect with it on that level anymore. We go into grocery stores. We don't understand what's given itself for that purpose. We don't understand the value of things and what it has taken to give you that meal or give you that medicine. And because of that, Even when we're sick, we don't even appreciate our healing processes. We don't appreciate what's in the healing for us. And so that's why it's really important. Because when you're properly thankful, then you're properly healed, you're properly healthy, you're properly respectful. And then if you can learn to appreciate those things, then you can be appreciated. You're just one little piece in the universe. You're not the dominant piece. And it's sort of reminding yourself of that, the humility that you should have as a human being. The further we move away from ourselves and our connection to the earth, the further removed we get from the appreciation of what is being given to us from the earth.
Robert Watt was selected by the elders as caretaker of the ancient village and burial grounds. "Take care of your ancestors, and your ancestors will take care of you," he says. The Sinek's presence in Balakin is now the longest peaceful occupation of Crown land in Canadian history. For the Sinek's, the repatriation of the ancestral remains continues to be a top priority.
The Sinaigs were quite powerful, and we were basically a kind of a court system. Not only that, we were very respected people in that the Sinaigs were very diplomatic in what they did and the endeavors they took on. And many times when there were disputes within our own grouping and also within outer groupings, where we were married into, because in order to maintain peace, there would be marriages with the Okanagans, the Shuswaps, marriages to the south, marriages to the east, and you just don't go in and fight with your relatives. I mean, you fight, but you don't kill them. So that was part of the way that we had a peaceful boundary, and also we had a lot of diplomacy. And because of our structure, people who couldn't settle disputes often came to the Sinaigs, and the Sinaigs people would listen to the dispute, and they would lay down a decision, and the people would abide by that decision, because those decisions were fair and just and moderate decisions, and we were known for that. So we not only had a lot of economic power, we had a lot of political power within that context of the respect that we had of the surrounding groups. And one of the reasons that we were powerful is because we had many resources here. This was the main trade route system coming up the Columbia River. So if you wanted to target someone, if you wanted to gain access to land, you needed to target the strongest group, because if you targeted the strongest group, then it would be fairly easy to oppress the less stronger groups. And so the Sinaigs became an extremely targeted group, and through the laws and policies and the impacts of those laws and policies, we were declared extinct in 1956. And then Minister of Indian Affairs Ron Irwin wrote and said, "For the purposes of the Indian Act, the Sinaigs were declared extinct. However, they never ceased to exist as a tribal group." So how you can be declared extinct but recognized as not being extinct was just part of a way of the government saying, of course they didn't cease to exist as a tribal group, but for the purposes of this Indian Act and for whatever purposes those policies and laws made happen, was why we were declared extinct. And because of that, many Sinaigs are part of other native groupings. And this is the other sort of oddball part about it, is that the Sinaigs exist on the U.S. side because we are a transborder nation. We, the Sinaigs people, represented all the way from the headwaters of the Columbia River down through Washington State. And if you wanted to access the power or the right to build dams and to do what you wanted to do with that water, then you had to gain the access and you had to get rid of the people. And there were lots of laws produced by the Indian Act, and those laws had very negative impacts. And one of those laws was the disenfranchisement of Native women. If you were an Indian woman and you married a non-Native, you were no longer considered an Indian. You were totally disenfranchised. In our culture, it was a matrilineal system. A matrilineal society is when the mother or the woman really has the control and the power, and your lineage, who you are, follows your mother, not your father. Like, you live in a patrilineal society today. You take your father's name. In our culture, children follow their mother. They follow their mother's tribe or band or identity. The women really control the land base. And so that was an important aspect of who we are, and that was part of our matrilineal society. And so the Indian Act targeted Native women. We are still feeling the impact of that today, because if you targeted Indian women, you actually targeted the future generations of the people, because they're the ones who had the babies. And a lot of reasons that we were matrilineal systems is because you knew who your mother was. You always knew who your mother was. You were nurtured by your mother. And wherever you followed your culture, the women were bound to the culture in a way that was different from a man, because we had the domestic skills to provide the children with the knowledge of their culture. The women were the ones who sat and told the stories and gave the children their oral history and tied them to the land like men couldn't, because we nurtured them from the womb until they were old enough to go on their own. Matrilineal structures supported each other. Women supported each other. They shared roles of gathering, childcare, storytelling. And in the recent past, say if a Sinaixt woman married an Okanagan man, that Okanagan man would more than likely move to Sinaixt territory and be a part of the woman's community, because that was just what was expected. When you took a woman and took her out of her element and placed her in another element, she didn't have that family support system. And so you sort of broke a tie to her community.
A visitor to the Columbia Basin will be unlikely to see any indication that there was ever a Native culture that thrived for so long in this region. Most of the Sinaixt traditional villages and burial grounds were flooded with the damming of the Arrow Lakes. We know of only one monument to the Sinaixt. In the town of Edgewood, there is a totem pole that was erected in the late 1960s. It was commissioned by BC Hydro as a commemoration to an extinct race. But the Sinaixt are not extinct.
We really feel like it's our responsibility to protect our burial sites. And are we going to slap everybody with an injunction who tries to build a house or does this or does that? And that was kind of used as a fear tactic. And we said, no, that's not it really.
And oftentimes, under a lot of pressure from other members of the community who just wanted us to leave, didn't want us to come back, people actually took bulldozers and plowed under pit house sites, because they thought if the Sinaixt people came back that we would come and take their land away from them or try and take something away from them. And a lot of that was fear-mongering of pitting one group of people against another, creating that fear dynamic so that people couldn't just say, well, it's a good thing they're back. Why can't we be sensitive to their burial sites? Why can't we ask them if this is a good place or isn't a good place, or if there's something we could do that would appreciate this land in a way that
recognizes those historical factors and has value for those historical factors because they're also part of your history as members of the community and land base as well. There were a lot of supporters, actually. These families were really supportive, like right from the very beginning, and really encouraged the Sinaites to come back and supported our stand to be there. What we'd like to do is have our community, which are all the members in our territory, say, we recognize the Sinaites, we recognize the Sinaites territory, and so by our community recognizing us, then the government has to recognize us. And then those constituent numbers mean something. And that's how we'll be asking our community to help.
The one way we don't want to go about it is asking the government to recognize us to us as wrong, because we're a sovereign people, and a sovereign people don't go up and ask somebody to recognize them. They're sovereign, that's all there is to it. It's not like our mistake. We didn't write papers and laws and things like that saying that our people were extinct, so it's not our mistake, it's the government's mistake, and we don't think we should have to go to them and ask them anything to recognize us or anything. It was their ideal to do it that way. To me, it's just like a way of wiping something out, destroying something. One way is you can just do it like in the physical, totally wipe it all out. Another way is just to do it on paper, so you no longer exist.
We have a gathering here, usually on the Canadian Thanksgiving weekend. We have a community gathering at the Balkan site. That Sunday, it's when we open up the camp to the community, and it's sort of a potluck, and we talk about who we are, and we usually have like a giveaway ceremony there and just talk about what we're trying to do. And if you ever want to come and visit during that time, or you don't have something going on, you know, you're always welcome. That's our time to open up to the community. The rest of the time, unless we're specifically asked by groups to come and visit the site is a private site.
It is our hope that this program has served to introduce you to a group of people who have a passionate cultural identity and an ancient historical connection with this land. We would like to thank Robert Watt and Marilyn James for sharing their stories and allowing us to present them. Thanks to Jackie Haywood for her assistance, to Eileen Perks for the opening passage, and Walter Basica for the music. Contributors to this feature were Freya Zaltz, Stevland Ambrose, Shannon Hammond, and Aaron Desolé. This show was produced entirely by youth using consensus to make decisions within the group as part of the 1999 Earth Matters program. A for youth, by youth program, Earth Matters seeks to link a variety of community, social, and environmental issues. Earth Matters is a program of the Nelson District Community Resources Society, and is sponsored by Selkirk College and Youth Service Canada, which is administered by the Nelson Human Resource Center. Equipment and assistance provided by Terry Brennan and Kootenai Co-op Radio, with strong technical support from Tom Clegg, without whom this documentary would never have been realized.
I think there is a way, and although I don't know the answers or anything, but I know it's just like the Indian people aren't going to go away and aren't going to leave, and the non-Indian people aren't going to go away and leave either. So there's, no matter whether we like it or not, we are going to be around each other. And it is up to both sides and how everybody approaches that and how it's going to be into the future. It's almost like that dancing I was talking about. We can look back at our past and see what caused trouble with us, with each other, with our environment, and we can say, well, we're going to do better in the future. And all of us are going to have to try to do something to make it better, you know, for the future. and especially for the children.